meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order at, oh, it looks like 10:19 a.m. on March 5th. Members present are Representative Zolkowski, Representative Rauscher, Representative Lincoln, Vice Chair Representative Sponholz, and myself, Chair Hopkins. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today are our recording secretary, Butch Carver, and our LIO moderator, Tom Raymond. They will join us during our committee meetings to ensure that we have accurate minutes, clear audio, video, and smooth telephonic testimony as well. My committee aide, Joe Hardenbrook, is also back there. And in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and hold off on introductions today until we have a full meeting. And I've circulated the contact form to hopefully fill out so that if you have any questions, you and your staff can stay in the loop and the committee can get to its work. Before we start with the presentation from Ms. Mira Kohler, I'd like to take care of a little bit of housekeeping. Please note that there's some memos on your desk regarding bill hearing requests and amendments to legislation before the House Special Committee on Energy. This memo has also been distributed to all of our members in the House. Please let the record reflect that we also have Representative Fields with us now. We also have distributed a memo regarding amendments in the House Special Committee on Energy. To allow for members to fully understand the amendments to legislation before our committee, we respectfully request members submit their amendments to the committee aide 24 hours prior to the hearing which the amendment will be considered. Our committee aide will work with legislators and staff to ensure you have documents and materials you want during the committee meetings, so if there's any special requests, please let us know. The available documents will be uploaded to BASIS, and a link will be emailed by 5 p.m. the day before the committee hearing. New documents, if there's any, will be provided in hard copy the day of the hearing. Please let our aides know if you would prefer not to get these so we can save killing any trees. Finally, our scheduled meeting time is Tuesday and Thursday, normally from 10:15 to 12:15. We expect to meet at least weekly for the rest of the session, and we'll be working with our finance subcommittee in the next coming weeks, which will be the one immediately following today's hearing and the future as well. If there are any questions, let's see, are there any other questions before we move on to the presentation? No, we're good? All right. We will continue today's meeting with an overview from Ms. Mira Kohler, the CEO of the Alaska Village Electrical Cooperative, about the Power Cost Equalization Program and the role this program plays in providing lower cost electrical power to rural residents of Alaska. Ms. Kohler, you can come on up, please. And you can please introduce yourself when you get there and put yourself on the record. And if the committee has any questions, please wait till the end of the slide and I'll recognize you so we can get started. So thank you very much and please begin.
I appreciate the invitation to be here today. This program that you're going to hear about is something that's very near and dear to my heart, and I hope to make it equally near and dear to your hearts today. My name is, can you hear me? Am I recording?
You just the microphone.
Snag it around.
How's that? Better? Okay. My name is Mira Kohler. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. A little later on in this presentation, I'll give you an overview of Alaska Village Electric. We'll call it AVEC for short. PCE also is Power Cost Equalization. I will call it PCE, so we save five syllables. And we'll go forward from there. So with that, I'll go ahead and begin. It works. So I'm going to take you briefly back to 1977. That was the year that oil first flowed down the pipeline. And at that time, if you look at the electrical picture in Alaska, there was virtually no transmission system in Alaska. Chugach Electric was the big utility, still is the big utility. And they owned a transmission line that went from the Beluga River gas fields to Anchorage and provided power from there to Anchorage. Fairbanks was entirely on heavy oil and coal, and diesel fuel was the primary source of power everywhere else. I was actually just chatting with Homer Electric yesterday, and their first electric power was provided by a 75-kilowatt diesel generator to their 56 community residents that received the power, so that was back in the 40s. There was almost no hydropower in the state, or very little. There was the Eklutna Power Project that served the Anchorage area, Anchorage and Matsu area. It was 30 megawatts at the time. It's 47 megawatts today. There was a little hydro that was owned by Chugach called Cooper Lake. And then there was the Snettisham Project that served Juneau, which is still functioning today. and about 20 megawatts of additional hydro around the state, primarily in southeast Alaska. So oil started flowing down the pipeline, and the state started to wonder what it was going to do with its newfound wealth. And so at that time, it was very much the focus that affordable energy was really heavily needed all over the state of Alaska. So a transmission line to Fairbanks got started about that time in the late 70s, early 80s, the Susitna project, which was at that time a 1,600 megawatt project. The latest version that you've heard about was a 600 megawatt project, which is still large, but we were talking about a much larger one. The Bradley Lake project, which is a 90 megawatt hydro that is across from Homer, was also started that time. The Four Dam Pool projects was started. Those were the projects that served the communities Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan in southeast, and Kodiak and Valdez. And those were primarily state-funded with a mixture of grants and bonds. And the state commissioned a major study. I well remember that study. It was a Stone and Webster study that was conducted in the early 80s, five volumes, about 3 inches thick. And they were looking for options for affordable energy for the entire state. So oil price, you may all remember, we had an oil embargo with the OPEC countries in the late 70s. The price of fuel spiked. The cost of electricity across the state in diesel-powered communities skyrocketed. And that triggered the start of the very first assistance program. That program was called the Power Production Cost Assistance Program. And so it was something that utilities had to apply for, and it essentially provided a cost subsidy to bring down the cost of electricity for those diesel-powered communities. It was only a one-year program, and then the following year, in 1981, the legislature then switched it over into what they called the PCA, or Power Cost Assistance Program. So that was the precursor to the PCE program, and it lasted for 3 years, essentially. It was intended to self-extinguish after 5 years, but it continued for 3 years, and then by 1984, that was when the legislature decided to implement the Power Cost Equalization Program. So it took the PCA program and then amended it so that it could apply, because at that time, they essentially gave up. The consultants determined that there really wasn't a practical silver bullet alternative for rural Alaska, and we were going to have to do something different. And so the commitment was made then to abandon more or less the very large-scale investments like they'd made in the hydro projects, and to focus on simply a subsidy for rural Alaska. So when PCE first started, it basically subsidized the first 750 kilowatt hours for residential consumers, and not just residential, actually all consumers got PCE on the first 750 kilowatt hours. It established a floor. That floor was 8.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And that was about what the cost of electricity was in the rail belt at that time. So Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks, of course, since it was now receiving power from Anchorage, its rates had dropped significantly. Juneau at that time was about 7 cents a kilowatt hour, so it averaged out to about 8.5. So who's eligible to get PCE? Any community that in 1983, in calendar year 1983, received 3/4 of its electricity from diesel-fired generation was eligible for PCE. Specifically excluded from that by name were the Four Dam Pool communities and any that were connected via the rail belt. And that was because they had already received a very substantial injection of cash by building those facilities. So at that time, the floor was set at 8.5 cents, and then the ceiling, which is if you have costs that exceed this level, which is 52.5 cents per kilowatt hour, then any cost above 52.5 cents simply dropped off. So if your electricity cost $1 a kilowatt hour, then you would get subsidy on the first up to 52.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and the remaining 47.5 cents you had to pay for full price. There is one example of one community that's always been up in the very high range, and that's Lyme Village. I don't know if that rings a bell for any of you. It's a very small community, and they've tried a variety of ways to make it affordable over there. Everything has to be flown in. There's only about 25 people that live there. And so the cost of electricity there has always been about $1 a kilowatt hour or more. Today, it's $1.76. So, you know, you can't get everybody, but that is the way it is. So in addition to users that got 750 kilowatt hours subsidized by PCE, community facilities receive PCE on all of their electricity used up to a certain threshold. So that threshold was calculated by, for each resident in the community, 70 kilowatt hours a month are allowed for community facilities. So to put that into perspective, if you have a community of 500 people, then you're allowed PCE on the first, let's say, 35,000 kilowatt hours used in a month. And that will typically pay for a water project, a water and sewer project, possibly a washateria, street lighting, a little community city hall, something like that. What we have found from our own experience at AVEC is that about half of that limit is used by communities. So about half of that is not used because they simply don't have the ability or the need for that many kilowatt hours. So that threshold has proved pretty solid. There are a couple of communities that push that limit and sometimes go over, in which case they don't receive PCE on any kilowatt hours they use above that. But it's not a frequent thing. So what has happened between 1985 and 2017? I use 1985 because the program started in October of 84, so that was FY85, but the first full year of the program really was the full year of 1985, and so that's the number that I use. So the floor, which was at 8.5 cents, is now 19 cents a kilowatt hour. So what that means is that the average cost of residential electricity in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage is now 19 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's a pretty substantial increase. The ceiling was raised from 52.5 cents to $1 a kilowatt hour. There are 22 communities in the state as of the last PCE annual report that are at 90 cents or more a kilowatt hour in cost. In terms of the number of kilowatt hours, it's a pretty small amount because they're typically very small communities, but we do have several that are over, there's 12 of them that are over $1 a kilowatt hour. The eligible amount of electricity has been dropped from 750 kilowatt hours to 500 kilowatt hours. And that essentially, what that has done is it has reduced the amount of kilowatt hours that are eligible for PCE by about 40% over the life of the program. Only 1 meter per resident is allowed. I remember the early days of PCE. I lived in Cordova at the time, and people were putting a meter on the garage and a meter on the house and a meter on some other place so that they could get PCE in all of those meters. Well, that went away when they changed that to 1 meter per household or per member, as it were. So that was how it evolved over time. Commercial users were dropped out of the program, and that was about 1999 that happened. So about 6,000 accounts of all of the accounts out there do not get PCE because they're commercial or school or state, federal, all those kind of accounts. Fuel cost for these communities has gone up by 127%. If you look back in time, back when the program started, fuel was $1.17 a gallon. In between, it went up to over $4 a gallon. We all remember the 2008 when the cost of a barrel of oil was at $147, but it has come back down since, and so the last complete year of the PCE report was $2.66. So the cost has gone up. But what is notable is that the efficiency of these communities has gone up dramatically. So back in the beginning of the PCE program, the cost of fuel per kilowatt hour is about 10 cents. Today, it's about 19 cents a kilowatt hour. And the fuel efficiency has gone from about 10.5 kilowatt hours per gallon to about 14 kilowatt hours per gallon on average. So things have improved dramatically. Non-fuel costs are up only about 31% over those 30 years, 30-plus years, so that's a pretty remarkable story all of itself. So the most recent year's funding was $28 million, and that is at 100% funding level. The reason I tell you that is because there were about 15 years during the program where, because it was an annual battle with the legislature to procure funding for PCE, we often got, and for 15 years in a row, we got less than full funding. And so it hinges upon the amount of money that's appropriated for the program. And when less is appropriated than what would be required under the funding formula, then the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, essentially prorates the amount of the rate of PCEs so as to keep it within the window of what money has been appropriated. So there were years when we had 60-65% of full funding. So you know, those are the challenges of the middle years until we were able to establish the endowment fund over time.
Ms. Kola, can you define for us what some examples of non-fuel costs are?
I actually, a little bit later on here, have a little breakdown of what our non-fuel costs are so you can see what all goes into it. But it's everything other than fuel. So it's power plant operations, it's distribution operations, it's billing and collections, it's insurance, it's depreciation, it's the cost of borrowed money. All of those things are rolled in. And I actually do have a slide that shows you the breakdown in pennies per kilowatt hour of those non-fuel costs. I know that's near and dear to your heart, so you'll get a look at that in just a moment. So back in 1986, the first year, full year of the program, PCE accounted for $17.8 million. In FY17, which is 30 years later, it was $26.1 million. So there hasn't been a lot of change over the years. So this is a snapshot of going back from 1986 all the way to 2017, what has changed. So you see that the total population served back in the first full year was 62,000 people. In 2017, it was 84,000 people. Total sales, gigawatt hours, which is a million kilowatt hours, has gone up. It's doubled, the number of kilowatt hours that have been sold in those communities. You can see the eligible kilowatt hour sales, PC eligible sales, have gone from 108 to 133, so very modest. You see that line which says what percentage of all electricity sold in a community is eligible for PCE. In the beginning, it was 48%. In 2017, it was 29%. The cost of fuel per gallon is laid out over there. The total gallons of fuel consumed. What I would point out to you is that in 1986, 21 million gallons were used to generate 225 million, or 225 million kilowatt hours. And in 2017, 29 million gallons of fuel were used, so a very modest increase, to produce more than twice as much electricity. So that's quite a story of success. I would say that what the Alaska Energy Authority has done over the years, and you know what we've done, we've got 58 communities, has made a significant difference in the efficiency of the fuel that's being used. So you have the total fuel cost.
Yeah. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt your slide, but the average percentage eligible, 30% in 2000, 29%. Is that by design, or is it just working out that way?
Well, as I said, when the program was first established, all users got PCE, and the threshold was higher. And so now a large number of the users in the communities don't get PCE. So all the commercial, small commercial, any usage over 500 kilowatt hours a month, none of that is eligible for PCE. So the eligible amount of sales has gone down, and that was by design. And those were the design changes that occurred in the late 1990s and early 2000s to bring the cost of the program within parameters that it, that was felt was defensible.
Thank you. Ms. Kohler, the renewable energy projects that have come online in rural Alaska, how do those interact with the PCE program? Are they off the plate, or are they not eligible, or are they still eligible?
What I told you back in the very beginning is if a community received 75% of its electricity from diesel in 1984 or 1983, then they're always going to be a PCE community. So an example I always like to throw out there is Cordova. And Cordova now has two hydro projects, and they are 75% hydro and 25% diesel, depending upon what happens in any one year. They are still on the PCE program, and because the PCE program covers more than fuel cost, it covers non-fuel costs as well. So in Cordova, for example, a large amount of money was borrowed and invested in those hydro projects, so there's a very large debt component of having those projects, and so they continue to get PCE, because without PCE, their rates would be similar to ours. It would be in the 40 to 45 cents a kilowatt hour. So with PCE, the residential rate is dragged down. Same thing with wind projects. We have wind projects in 13 locations, and we serve 20 communities with that wind project. So what we have is we know what the cost of that wind is, because we know what all of the costs of operation are, and those are captured through our non-fuel costs, and so they go into the PCE funding formula. So yes, they don't negatively impact PCE, right? And that's, again, later on in this, I talk about, you know, some of the questions associated with the program is, doesn't it discourage renewable investment? Well, no. For us, more than half of our kilowatt hours sold are not eligible for PCE. So our focus is still always to drive down that cost, whatever way that occurs. And so it's for us, it has not been a deterrent.
Thank you.
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
That feels.
So you're saying that based on the way that you structure with non-fuel costs, essentially you can, PCE can be a financing source for what are over time more affordable investments. Is that another way of saying that?
And Representative Fields, through the chair, that actually is something I have worked with a group, including the Energy Authority and others, on how you can potentially use the program in a modest way to help you pay for major investments. So, for example, a frustration that we have is that a small community doesn't have the wherewithal to pay for an overhaul. And so for them, it's easier to let that generator fail and then have the state replace it, which we think is just abominable, because that the cost of that overhaul, if it's properly structured, you can include it into your rate structure, and PCE will help to offset the ongoing cost of that overhaul. I actually do have a white paper that I've written on that. I would be happy to share it with you if you would like me to send that to you later. But yes, it's a program that has the potential to provide a lot of assistance in ways that are not, that don't break the bank, to make communities more self-sufficient.
If you could send that to me, I'd make sure to distribute it to the committee.
I would love to do that.
Thank you.
And so right at the bottom of this slide, you'll see that what component of total cost does PCE cover? In 1986, the PCE program essentially covered 32% of the costs of operation. In 2017, it's 16%. So what that means is that 84% of the cost of rural electricity is borne by the communities themselves. So it's not a huge amount, but it makes it possible for these communities to stay alive. So now a little bit about AVEC. As I said in passing, we serve 58 communities. Bethel is our largest community. We picked them up in 2014. We are also in Southeast since the last couple of years. We picked up Yakutat recently. So we really are spread out across the state. We do have one village that you can get to by road, and that's Minto, which is about 100 miles from Fairbanks. So the population that we serve represents about 38% of the total number of beneficiaries of PCE, but we actually receive about 41% of PCE because our communities tend to be a little larger and a little more expensive, and we carry all our own operating costs. So when you see a standalone community, very often a lot of their operating costs are picked up by the state through the Alaska Energy Authority program. Our communities do not. We never receive that. We do it all ourselves. So our costs are a little higher. Yes, so our smallest community is less than 100, and we actually have four or five that are less than 100.
One second, Mr. Field, Representative Fields has a question.
What's the process of Yakutat joining AVAC? What does that mean in terms of services that AVAC provides to Yakutat?
Yakutat actually approached us about whether it would be logical for them to become a part of our group. It was a municipal utility, and they just didn't have the expertise to operate the system, and so they felt like they were underutilizing what they did have. And so, you know, I mean, we have journeyman linemen, we have journeyman mechanics, we have wind technicians, we have highly qualified people, we have our own engineers, and most communities don't have that. And so that was something that Yakutat saw as a benefit for themselves. And so we went through the process, and what we do is we very frequently get requests from communities, very small communities, to become a part of AVAC. The problem we run into is they're so small, the kilowatt hour sales are so small, that we can't possibly garner enough money from them to pay for their own operation. We know about what it costs to operate a power plant. It's about $150,000 a year. We know what it costs to operate a distribution system. And if we can't get enough revenue from the community so that it is not going to be subsidized by other communities, we just say no. Because, you know, we're a private organization. We are a nonprofit, but we are member-owned, and we have to look out for our members. And somebody that's not yet a member doesn't have the same degree of priority that our own members do. So we have to be selective about that. I especially don't like the calls that I get saying, Mira, we've got the system here. It's on their last generator. The distribution system is falling down. Things are a mess over here. Please come and help them out. And we go, we can't. I mean, how is it going to pay for itself? I get that from Platinum regularly. You're probably aware of that. Anyway, so this is just to give you a little snapshot of this our size in terms of small and large communities. This slightly shrunk up map over here shows you where our communities are. I know it's pretty hard to read, but you can pinch it on your phone, I'm sure, or your iPad, and see. As you can see, we're in Western Alaska. So Minto by Fairbanks is our interior village, and then we have, of course, the villages of Nulato, Huslia, Caltag that are also considered interior villages. We've got one on Kodiak Island. Old Harbor is our community on Kodiak Island. We've got four or five in the Bristol Bay area, and actually we're going to be getting Twin Hills very soon, which is a small community a couple miles north of Togiak. They're under direction. They're going to build a tie line from there to Togiak, and so the only cost for us to serve them will be a distribution expense, so we can afford to take them on, so they'll be coming on board. And then you have Yakutat in Southeast Alaska, so that's where we are. We operate 50 power plants. We have 13 wind systems that serve 20 villages. Our typical wind turbine is 100 kilowatt north wind turbine, but in the, just last year, we installed two larger turbines. They're 900 kilowatt machines. I'm sure you've seen them around the state. There's a couple in Delta Junction, there's a couple in Nome, and a couple in Kotzebue. So we have one in Bethel now, and one in St. Mary's. So we buy about 8.5 million gallons of diesel fuel a year to serve our communities.
Can I ask a question on that? Yeah. How many of those wind systems were at least partially financed by the Renewable Energy Fund?
So we started building our wind systems in 2003. So that predates the Renewable Energy Fund, which was established in 2008. So the five that we installed before then had no state participation. Since then, we've had partial state participation in a number of our systems. Obviously, for the last couple, 3 years, for example, the Bethel project. Actually, the Bethel project, the city of Bethel won a $3 million grant from the Renewable Energy Fund back in the early years, 2011, 2012. And then they turned that money over to us, and we applied that towards the wind system. But most of, for the most part, Denali Commission plays a big role. So we have Denali Commission money, we have some DOE money, and we have Renewable Energy Fund money. So probably about six of those systems have Renewable Energy Fund money, and all of them are partial because you know, there was never really enough there to pay for the entire system.
And we should be having a presentation from the Alaska Energy Authority in a couple of weeks to touch on those sort of issues.
Right, right. Yeah. And they told me that they were going to be doing that.
Yeah.
So, so there's some statistics for us. And here, a little bit more about our total sales, 118 million kilowatt hours, total revenues. Our residential cost right now is about 48 cents, but the total revenue per kilowatt hour is about 44 cents. And I'd show you that we are 41% of the total PCE that's dispersed. It's about $10.7 million in the most recent year completed. And it represents about 21% of our total revenue. The other 80% obviously comes from the users themselves. I did a snapshot off a few things here. The first question is, does PCE reduce rural power costs to urban levels? And so what I did was I took the retail residential power cost as of 2017. And so for Chugach Electric, it was almost 20 cents a kilowatt hour. At Golden Valley, which is Fairbanks, it's 24 cents. Juneau is just under 12 cents, which is what brings the average down to 19.02 cents. Kodiak Electric is one of the winners. They're a Ford Ampool member. They're a little over 15 cents. So then the next five are asterisked, and those asterisks indicates that this is the cost after PCE for the first 500 kilowatt hours. So Kotzebue Electric is a little over 19 cents. Ours is about 23 cents. Bettles, which is an interior village, is at 31 cents. The Middle Kuskokwim villages, which is the Stony River, Crooked Creek, Tropoluk, those five communities there, they're at about 41 cents. And then Napakiak, which is actually a village that we serve, we provide them wholesale power, they're almost 50 cents a kilowatt hour.
Okay. Jump in here. I just find it impressive that Kodiak has cheaper energy than Anchorage. I know Kodiak did use REF money. What's that?
Hydro.
Hydro and wind. And I believe, if I recollect correctly, back in the early 2000s, Kodiak made a decision to go to a more renewable portfolio, and they've actually held energy costs constant or in inflation-adjusted terms dropping, which is remarkable compared to the rate increases we've seen in Anchorage. And I just wonder, what opportunities do we have to do more Kodiaks around the state and save consumers money with renewable portfolios?
Well, Kodiak just has the perfect storm situation for them, except that it's a very nice storm to have. They've got a wonderful hydro project. It's a 20 megawatt project that was built by the state in the mid 80s, and that project was dispersed. Back in 2000, when the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund was established, these, what we call the Ford Ampool, because they're four projects, they were essentially sold back to the communities that they served. So Kodiak received its hydro paid for at 20 cents on the dollar for what was paid for that project. They have been very forward-thinking and have... they're actually in the process right now of putting in a third turbine that's going to expand the capacity of the hydro. And they built the wind in two phases. Now, yes, they did receive $4 million from the Renewable Energy Fund for the first tranche of the three wind turbines they put in. But that was a $23 million project. So the Renewable Energy Fund only provided less than 20% of the cost of that project. But it all cobbled together. They also used the Clean Renewable Energy Bonds. That was a federal program to help fund it. They were already at 90-plus percent renewable when they went to wind. And what they have done, I mean, they are a remarkable story. And it's a story of perseverance and leadership and willing to put a lot of money into becoming ever more renewable, because they see the volatility of diesel fuel, and that's a big challenge that they had to meet. So yeah, 15 cents, I would give you limbs for that 15 cents. At least parts of limbs, how's that?
Yeah,
it is quite a story.
So I think just in a follow-up to underscore your point that Kodiak has access to renewable resources in a way that are just unremarkable and probably not able to be duplicated in other parts of Alaska, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Yes, and that's exactly right. Hydro is a fabulous resource. Southeast has it, but everywhere else, you know, we've struggled to find options for hydro, you know, kinetic hydro. In Yakutat, we've been engaged on a wave study to see if something can be captured there. Back when I was in NACNIC in the early 1990s, I was hoping to be able to do local natural gas resource over there. In fact, did an innovative project doing a thermal mapping of the whole area. No time for that over here, but yes, I mean, we have all struggled for years and years and years to find alternatives that are going to work, that are locally sustainable, that are affordable, that give us 15-cent power, and they are elusive.
Guys, could follow on that?
Yeah, just 1 second. There was a renewable energy atlas done about 10 years ago or so. Was that valuable for work on trying to find some other small-scale renewable energy projects?
We were actually a part of funding that original project. It was one that was spearheaded by Renewable Energy Alaska Project and AEA and NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado. And we were also a partial funder of that because what we wanted was more effort put into a more refined map. There were some very broad-scale maps of, for example, wind resources, geothermal, and so forth. And so we were able to help refine that. Has it been useful for us? You know, that's yes and no, because I can tell you that we have gotten turned down for projects where we were pretty sure we had a better wind resource than the map was showing. Mm-hmm. But the map is more generalized for that general area. But, you know, when you live in a particular area and you know what's going on over there. So it's been a frustration in some instances, but it is a good resource. It does show you where those resources are and whether there might be potential to tap it. But tapping those resources is very, very expensive. You may be familiar with Pilgrim Hot Springs north of Nome. That was considered to be potentially a nice resource, but it's 65 miles from Nome. And, you know, they came to me and said, well, why don't you help us develop this and you can have cheap power in Teller and Brevik Mission. I'm going, 70 miles of transmission for 5 megawatts of power? I just don't think that's going to pencil out. And so, you know, there are hopes and aspirations, but their reality sometimes casts a very sharp light on it. Anyway.
Representative Fields, do you have a question still?
Yeah, well, Representative Zolkowski's question prompted this. So while we're on this discussion of locally available resources and wind, I know Kodiak has both flywheel and battery backup now, which has enabled them to get to 99% renewable and helped make the wind more economical. Do you see the rapid advancement of battery technology and apparently relatively new flywheel technology as energy storage as enabling either broader application of wind in your communities and or making the 13 communities where you already have wind installations more efficient and cover a larger share of their energy needs?
A long question that focuses on storage as an asset. The storage is coming along at a very good pace. We are very optimistic that it's going to play a significant role down the road. It's still extremely expensive, and the challenge that we have in our communities is we're not on rock like Kodiak is. You know, having a rock foundation allows you to have a very delicately balanced item like a flywheel actually function. When we put in our wind turbines in our communities, we have to drive piles 60 feet into the ground and in order to anchor, because you can't get to bedrock. You're anchoring in permafrost. And so you have real challenges with that. One of the things that we are engaged in is we are actually on a program that's funded by the Idaho National Labs, NREL, Pacific Northwest Lab, ASAP, two universities, and Cordova and us are part of a project, and we're developing a system that we call a grid bridging system. And so it's a different form of storage that would allow us the 90 seconds of capacity to bring a diesel generator online so we can go diesels down. So, you know, later.
Okay.
It's moving along. And you're getting to the end of your time here.
I was just going to say, we've got about 15 minutes left.
Oh, you do? So, okay. Yeah, all right. Sorry, I can be a little gabby. And
so can we, so it's fair.
Oh, good. Anyway, so here is a comparison of what the cost of 700 kilowatt hours are for a home in these communities. And you can see the winner here is Juneau at $83. Next is Kodiak at $107. The big loser is the Middle Kuskokwim villages that are $420 for 700 kilowatt hours. And our villages average $219. So it gives you an idea of what a 700 kilowatt hour bill costs. Remember that only the first 500 kilowatt hours are eligible for PCE. So 200 kilowatt hours are at full cost. And that's why this is higher. Who gets PCE? I already went over this, but let's just talk about community facilities for a moment. Street lights, it's public lighting, washeterias, water sewer facilities, and community buildings. So in most villages, for example, the clinic is eligible for PCE because they just receive lump sum funding from typically IHS or an entity like that. That helps to offset some of their costs, and their electric bill is not included in that, and so they are eligible because it is a public facility. The hospital in Bethel is not eligible, so don't even go there, because it is funded by the federal government and through private insurance, and so that basically takes it out of eligibility. So it's always a bit of a tussle. We try very hard to maximize community facility PCE, but it is determined by the Energy Authority as to who is going to be eligible or not. And so I'm on their case all the time about ones that are languishing, but they always get to them eventually. So that's who gets PCE. Who doesn't get PCE? Schools don't get PCE because they're primarily state-funded. And so it would be taking out of one pocket and putting into the other. So they've never been eligible. Anything funded by the government, state or federal government, is not eligible. Commercial customers are not eligible. If you have a business in your home and more than 25% of the electricity that's used is for the business, that whole home becomes ineligible for PCE. And consumers that are not paying their bills, they essentially fall off the PCE program because they're seriously delinquent.
What was the threshold on commercial activity?
I think it's about 25%. Yeah. So if you're running a shop in your house, then the whole building becomes ineligible for PCE. Churches are not eligible for PCE. However, if the electricity is in the pastor's name and he's living there, then that would be eligible for PCE. So, it's a fine line. How does it work? The PCE program, the utility applies to the regulatory commission to participate, and we submit all of our detailed cost data. So they get a complete financial report from us every year that's pages and pages and pages long. And the RCA goes through those costs and then determines which ones are and which ones aren't PCE eligible. So, for example, lobbying costs are not eligible for PCE. When we have our annual meeting and we buy food for our delegates, that food is not eligible for being considered PCE eligible. So, minutia. But they do a good job with examining it. So then the RCA determines the PCE rate for the community. The utility then sends out bills, and it applies that PCE rate, and it issues a credit on the customer's bill. Then after the billing, the utility then sends the billing information to the Energy Authority and bills them for the PCE that's been already given to the consumers. And then eventually they reimburse us for what we have paid. The consumer is responsible to pay for the bill after the PCE credit, and then annually we have to file an update with the RCA because they redetermine our power cost equalization rate. Mm-hmm. So every time our fuel cost changes, we are expected to get a new PCE rate that's hinging upon the new fuel cost. So all utilities, at least our utility, has an automatic feature in our billing system so that as our fuel cost changes, we compute a new fuel cost rate. But we can't put it into effect until the RCA has given us a new PCE rate that uses that. They are very good about responding quickly, so this is not a rock I'm throwing at them. But there is a lag in passing on those costs. So the question that I had mentioned, does it discourage conservation and innovation? My answer to that is no, that is not the case. Only 29% on an overall basis of the electricity sold in PCE communities actually gets PCE. The other 71% does not. So there is 71% of those residents that or users that need to have whatever is possible done to reduce the cost of their electricity. I did want to point out that the smaller the community is, the more kilowatt hours typically are eligible for PCE because you have much lower commercial activity in those villages. And so AVEC, for example, 48% of our kilowatt hour sales are eligible for PCE. Cordova, it's 28% because they've got the processors there and they've got a lot of commercial activity. Kotzebue, about the same. So Kotzebue sells about 21 million kilowatt hours a year. So they're pretty big size in the grand scheme of things. Napakiak, 72% of their electricity sales are eligible. So this just gives you a snapshot of what that relative ratio is. So your question, Representative Lukowski, doesn't most of PCE go to overheads? So here are some statistics from the most recent published report. Total fuel costs were $76 million, non-fuel $85 million, for a total of $162 million. And the amount of PCE that was dispersed was $26 million. So it's 16% of all costs and 34% of fuel costs alone. So it actually doesn't even touch overheads or non-fuel costs. It's a long way from that. So this just answers that question. And what are overheads? So they are all non-fuel and costs. So that's operating and maintaining power plants, tank farms, distribution systems, customers, billing and collections, administration, accounting, engineering, warehouse, insurance. You'd be surprised, our insurance bill is $1.4 million a year for our communities. Depreciation of non-grant funded debt and cost of long-term debt. And of course, taxes and miscellaneous. So here is a picture of our non-fuel costs in 2017. You can see that the non-fuel costs total about 24 cents a kilowatt hour. You can see the breakdown. And the fuel component in 2017 was about 22 cents a kilowatt hour. So total of about 46 cents a kilowatt hour. So a question always arises.
Go for it, Representative Roger.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you go back to that last slide for a second?
This one?
Do we have different numbers than you?
Well, I've got. It would appear so.
Oh.
Oh, no, you have new ones. You have those, the ones in your...
So I had sent an earlier version to Joe, and then I went back, because that was a year old, that slide, and so I put the most current one in there.
There it is.
So, okay.
So that was throw out the old one and look at the new one. So
I was reading the numbers and I got
marked
on the wrong slide, but thank you very much for the clarification.
Sure. So you got the right one now?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Is that the only slide? I'm through the chair.
I think that was the... There were tweaks on others. For example, I capitalized the word state on another one. So there were three things that I fixed. And this was the most substantial one because those costs were from a prior year. And I wanted to have that to be current.
All right. Thank you very much.
This one hasn't changed. So there is the impression that communities that get PCE have no investment in plant because it's all paid for by the state or others. Now, in very small communities that are not AVEC communities, that could be true, and I don't know that for sure, but I can tell you that for us utilities that that are regulated in one form or another by the state, you can see what the plant investment per customer is, and you'll see that Kodiak is slightly higher than us because of that the wind and the new work that they're doing on their hydro project. But we have an average of over $14,000 per service invested in our villages. So this is the non-grant funded money. It's about $2 million per village, not counting Bethel, which is substantially higher. So those are the numbers. And I will also point out to you that in the lower 48, the average plant investment per service is about $2,500. So we are many times that cost. So this has been a longstanding fallacy that PCE is abused by communities, and I actually think that it is quite the opposite. I think that there are communities that don't have sophisticated accounting processes, and they don't necessarily capture all the costs that should be potentially eligible for PCE, because when I see villages where the cost of electricity after PCE is 30 and 40 cents, I know that there's a problem there. And if I had a couple days to sit and ferret through it, I could find that problem. But there are very stringent standards that are established by the state through both the RCA and the AEA that make sure that standards are met and that there is no abuse going on. I will point out at the very bottom, we write off less than 0.5% of revenues over the year due to bad debt. So I think that our customers pay their bills, and I would say that's true of others as well. And then, you know, the question that always arises, wouldn't that PCE money be better spent on alternative energy? The thing you have to remember is that wind generation costs six times as much as the cost of diesel generation, and it's an intermittent source, so you still have to have all that diesel generation and fuel storage in addition to whatever else. So I give you a few statistics here that tell you what average village loads are, which is about 150 kilowatts. The typical cost of a 300 kilowatt wind integration system, which we have several off, is about $4 million. And you still need the diesel generation and tank farms. This is basically my last slide. Why are we subsidizing rural Alaska? Because this was the compromise that was reached in 1984. Every dime that has gone into PCE is a quid pro quo. The same holds true of the PCE endowment fund, and that I gave you a printout that you have that gives you a legislative history of PCE. You have, you know, a former legislator here, Bill Thomas, who's been a key player in this whole program. Every dollar that was invested in the endowment fund as was part of a grand scheme compromise. The most recent one, the last $400 million that went in there in 2011, was actually part of a $1.1 billion compromise in the legislature. And so what I'm telling you here is that we can't afford to go back to annual battles for PCE. We need folks to understand how vital this program is.
Representative Zolkowski had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just recognizing that, recognizing our time frame. Ms. Kohler, you have a lot of experience and quite a tenure working in utilities throughout rural Alaska for quite a while. Stepping back to the previous slide, question 10, and talking about alternative energy, there's always a lot of conversation around pursuing alternative energy or even renewable energy throughout rural Alaska. Do you see that in your experience as being the number one priority in terms of helping to bring down cost drivers for utilities, or would, say, energy efficiency or addressing the cost of fuel to run these operations contribute more equitably than, say, investing in alternative energy? I mean, what is your assessment in that?
Representative Zolkowski, through the chair, it's always been the golden fleece that we've looked for is how do we displace diesel. My own board has a goal of displacing 25% of diesel used in our communities over a period of 10 years. And the big player there really is efficiency. If we can get another kilowatt hour per gallon of diesel fuel, you know, that's an 8% improvement in efficiency right off the bat, or in a reduction in fuel use from that. Because in rural Alaska, the options are so limited, the renewable resources are intermittent. And because they're intermittent, you still have all the attendant costs. We've actually achieved a very high displacement rate, which is one of the highest in the nation. And in some of our communities, we're approaching 40% of displaced fuel for electricity, for diesel fuels for electricity generation. that doesn't touch heat, though. And so when we did our project in St. Mary's, there's a 900-kilowatt turbine that's going to serve two communities that have been connected right now, Mountain Village and St. Mary's. The combined average load of those two communities is 600 kilowatts. So it is our expectation that we will have a substantial amount of surplus electricity. And what we do is we sell that at a very nominal rate for heat. We sell it to typically either the school or the water treatment plant, usually the water treatment plant, because that benefit stays in the community and it displaces diesel fuel that way as well. So we use excess electricity for heat generation. We do have a challenge with the way that the RCA figures our PCE, and they actually penalize us for any sales of recovered heat or, you know, excess wind that we make by taking that revenue out and calling it a reverse expense and reducing the PCE rate as a result. So in Bethel, for example, the community is paying 2 cents kilowatt hour more for their electricity because their PCE rate has been depressed by this practice. So when you talk to the new commissioner that's being appointed, be sure and make sure that you mention that PCE shouldn't be used as a tool to penalize communities for doing the right thing, because that's happening across the state in a number of our communities. So I'm kind of spearheading that effort as well.
Duly noted. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Kohler, for your presentation and for your work over all these years on with AVEC and across Alaska. So thank you very much for coming and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate being invited.
Absolutely.
I'm very proud to be your first one.
Our next meeting is going to be right after this at 11:15, the Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And our next meeting is the Special Committee on Energy is going to be Tuesday, March 14th. At 10:15 in the morning, we're going to be hearing a presentation by other utility cooperatives these on the Road Belt Electrical Transmission Line. The corresponding legislation is House Joint Resolution 10 by Representative Tallarico. We'll also be hearing a bill from Representative Thompson, which is pending referral. If there's no further business, we will go ahead and adjourn at 10 or 11:50, 16.